All right, so if somebody could help review chapter 6 for us, that would be great.
The king can't sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And so he reviews the daily log, which he's probably hoping would put him to sleep. That's
which is funny because it's supposed to be out about all the things that honored him, but.
And he realizes that Mordecai was never honored, so then he asks Haman, well, what would you do?
Oops, sorry.
So he says what he would have wanted because he thinks the king's going to honor him. And, well, then it goes to Mordecai.
Right. A little plot twist there.
And then Esther's, like, in the last line, or in the last, is only brought up in the last verse or something. Are you going to go? The eunuchs are coming. You have to go to this banquet. Are you going to go?
Sure.
And then Haman is, like, humiliated that he had to do this. So then
right.
He goes and runs off to his wife, and his friends are like, well, it's your downfall.
Right. Yep.
Well, because he was going to the king to ask if he could hang Mordecai. Yeah. And then the king makes him honor Mordecai.
Right. Yep.
God's version of trauma?
I know. I mean, we know God has a sense of humor, so.
Yes. She's right there. She's our busy season.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, how humiliating for Mordecai to have to parade around this man that he was planning to take out, and the very honor that he had suggested now was going to be bestowed on his enemy. I mean, it's just absolutely mortifying. And then he returns to his wife and his friends just humiliated. And then in the end there, does anybody remember what happened that Zeresh, the wife, said to Mordecai? Right. He's going
to
fall.
You began to fall before a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
Your downfall is certain.
Right.
What a great mindset. I know. This is kind of why he didn't sugarcoat things.
What?
Like it is.
And I mean, remember, just the evening before, she had just told him, hey, go avenge yourself. Go and kill Mordecai. You know, go hang him up on the gallows. And so she had just told him that. And so now suddenly she's become this theological bearer of what's going to happen to, or God standing with the Jews. And, you know, like we said last week, it's almost like she maybe had an idea that there was a God who looked out for the Jews. But yesterday when she was telling Mordecai to go and kill him, she maybe didn't really believe that that was really true. Well, now she's seen it play out before her eyes. She's watching her husband, who was second in command, now be really dishonored because he's now having to parade around this Jew who was supposed to be annihilated, right? And so she's watching it play before her eyes that there is a God who seems to be keeping his promises and playing out, you know, keeping his promises to the Jews, to this people that he has elected and chosen. She is watching that happen. And so now she's telling him, well, apparently it's true. Apparently God has a special thing for the Jews and you're toast. So, and then in verse 14, who hurries Haman away to the feast?
The eunuchs.
And do we remember what?
I forgot about that when I first read that. Mm-hmm.
Right. When the eunuchs appear with the Jews, it seems to be for their favor. We saw with Esther that it was for her favor. The eunuchs saw favor upon her. They lavished her in special treatment. When Vashti was brought around by the eunuchs, she was disposed and thrown out of the kingdom, the palace. And then now here, the eunuchs are hurrying Haman away to this feast. They would have been servants of the king that would have helped serve him, but they also wouldn't have been, they wouldn't have been, like a Jew would have been, a Jew would have been, not consecrated, circumcised, oh my word, there it is, but a eunuch would have been
castrated.
Castrated, right, for the king.
And that's why they could then serve in the harem and whatever.
Right. Mm-hmm. So they weren't getting people pregnant. Yep. No, it's fine. It's all right. It's...
created the gallows,
right?
The whole thing, and he's like, it's a good idea.
Yeah, but we did talk about that last week, and he did go along with what she said for the gallows. But with when it was the edict, the original edict, it does seem that he came up with that himself, because there's no indication that he went to his wife and asked permission. Because if you see in for the gallows. But for the original edict, when he wants to go before the king in chapter 3, it says, verse 8, it says, "Then Haman said to the king Ahasuerus, there's a certain people scattered abroad, dispersed among the peoples," and then he goes on to say that he wants them to be, killed. So it seems that it was his idea for the original edict back in chapter 3, because there's no indication of him talking to someone else. He's just filled with fury, and then he goes and talks to the king. But then... yes, when in chapter 5, when it's not enough for him to wait for them to be executed later on, he's got to take care of Mordecai now, then yeah, he takes his wife's suggestion and he's pleased by it, which is a little disturbing. Yes, right. It just says that the wife was the one who said, I guess it does say, and all his friends, yes, I guess it does say, then his wife... right.
And both,
yep.
Even in 6. Too.
Right. Yep. And the friends. Yep. And it.
Mhm. It's funny because Job had his friends. And
right.
And then you go into Proverbs where it says, evil companions.
Mhm. Right.
It all just, the whole thing just ties through.
Mm-hmm.
So even a child would have a good idea.
Sure. Yeah. It's important who your friends are and who you keep around you. Yep. Right.
Yeah.
Right. And there's that verse that says a friend with the blows is better than kisses from an enemy, right? That wounds from a friend. Yeah. Yes. All right. So, So the eunuchs hurry Haman away to the feast with Esther that she's prepared. And now we come to chapter 7. And this is, this is a big moment because, like we said last week, we are going to see in a span of 24 hours, Haman going from a worldly standpoint, he has it all. He's got wealth. He's got fame. He's got recognition. He has a standing in the empire. So from a humanly standpoint, he seems untouchable, right? But God doesn't work that way. God works very different. And in a span of 24 hours, he's going to go from that to being dead, completely dead. And to nothing. You're going to be reduced to nothing. So God works far outside of our ways. Okay, so if someone can read for us chapter 7, verse 1 through 6.
The king and Haman came to feast with Esther the queen. Once again, on the second day while drinking wine, the king asked Esther, "Queen Esther, whatever you ask will be given to you. Whatever you seek, even to half the kingdom, will be done." Queen Esther answered, If I have obtained your approval, my king, and if the king is pleased, spare my life. This is my request. And spare my people. This is my desire. For my people and I have been sold out to destruction, death, and extermination. If we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept silent. Indeed, the trouble wouldn't be worth burdening the king. King Ahasuerus spoke up and asked Queen Esther, "Who is this, and where is the one who has devised such a scheme?" Esther answered, "The adversary and enemy is this evil human." Haman stood terrified before the king.
All right, so the king and Haman went into a feast with the Queen Esther. So this word for feast, we've seen this many times. We've seen them having feasts many times before. That word for feast, does anybody's version say anything other than feast?
Drink.
Drink. Yep, drink. Verse 1, yep. Yep. So, banquet. Okay. So that word there for feast or to drink, the word in Hebrew is shatah, and in it is a verb which literally means to drink. So if you have it there. So there was likely that there was feasts that you were drinking at and feasts that you were eating at. But, you know, we see. But this here, it specifically was shatah, which is to drink. Okay. Yep. Yep. So that would be a more literal translation of it.
Maybe Esther knew the way to her husband's heart was
through wine. Right. Yep. Probably.
I know. Got rid of that.
Hey, Mom. You're fine. There's a chair right over here. You're fine. We just got to verse one, so you didn't miss a whole lot. Okay, so let's see. So one commentator thought that here in verse one, when it says it titles her Queen Esther, they felt like there was a distinction between. So in chapter five, we see kind of a similar verbiage that the king and Haman went to the feast with Queen with Esther. Verse five. Let's see, where is it? Verse 5 at the end, it says, so the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. So there it just says Esther. And then here it says Queen Esther. So one of the commentators thought, well, is this her kind of coming into, like he's really acknowledging her as queen. But when I went and like read through all of the chapters, like there's times where he calls her Queen Esther. There's times where the writer says just Esther. Like, it's very back and forth, and there doesn't really seem to be a lot of rhyme or reason to. It seems actually most of the time he refers to her as Queen Esther, majority of the time. There's one spot where I think he says Esther when she came before him. So, I don't know. I wouldn't put a whole lot of. I don't know why he was making that distinction, because there seems. The author. Just kind of picks and chooses when he labels her as Queen Esther and when he just says Esther. So I don't.
Maybe because just of the situation in verse 6 that he's terrified before the king and queen. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But there's so many other places where he refers to her as Queen Esther that I wouldn't really put a lot of salt in that.
It could also be a formality too because of her thesis. Thank you, queen.
Sure. Yep. Yep. And yeah. Yeah, I don't know. But the commentator that was commenting on that, he just saw the parallel in 5:5 where he says just Esther. And then here it's a similar wording of, so the king and Haman went into the feast with Queen Esther. But again, I don't know that we can really like make such a distinction. Okay, so then verse 2, and on the second day as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king again said to Esther, "What is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled." So where it says, and on the second day, we're once again just making a distinction that this is still that second day. It's not like Esther had said, "Can you come tomorrow for the feast?" This is still considered that day. It's not another day past that. Right. Yep. It still is that very next day. Because she said back in...
Well, it does say after the banquet or at the banquet.
Yeah. So they did, because I was reading.
Wine with food on the side.
Yeah. I read that a lot of times when the Persians would feast, their birthday was a huge feast. They would throw a huge feast. And they actually think that the king's birthday happened over that 180-day period of that feast, which, I mean, it's half the year. So it's very possible that his birthday fell upon that. But they made such a big deal of it. And oftentimes, Herodias recorded that they would roast whole horses and whole cows and whole, you know, whatever for their feasting. So they did eat food and they didn't just drink, but...
Like the emphasis is on the drink.
Yes, we know that the king likes to drink. So, and obviously, apparently, Esther knew that as well. And we have seen that she is very smart in how she goes about all these things. So I'm sure it was probably intentional to get him a little intoxicated. Okay, so yeah, again, like I said, this is still that very next day. Like Esther had said, "Come to me tomorrow," and it's. That is the same day, the following day. Okay. The king inquired of Esther's request. And, you know, I mean, this is the third time that he has said, what is your request, Esther? Up to half the kingdom. So I'm sure his interest is piqued. And like we kind of said last week, we wonder if maybe that was part of why he couldn't sleep last night, because he's wondering about her, right, what she wanted. Yep. But we don't know. I mean, I also really believe it was God's providence that he couldn't sleep on that very specific night.
That's what my commentary thought.
Mm-hmm.
It was talking about how Mordecai didn't know Esther's plan.
Right.
Esther didn't know Mordecai.
Right.
And God was not in the middle, but he was, you know.
Right. He's hidden but active. Right.
That's why.
Right.
More was the reason why he thought that.
Right.
He couldn't sleep.
Right. For sure. Yeah. It's very possible. Yep. So three times he has had asked this, and he's wondering, what is Esther going to ask of me? But, you know, again, Esther is very wise. She is not only beautiful, but very smart, because she has almost committed the king to saying yes to her request before she has even asked it, because three times he has offered up half the kingdom. And so he's going to look like a fool. His reputation will kind of be severed if he then doesn't grant her request. He's already said over and over and over, up to half the kingdom. So he's anticipating, you know, something big, and he's already basically, Esther has committed him to saying yes before he even has. Verse 3-4. Then Queen Esther answered, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish, and my people for my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. If we have been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss of the king." Okay, so verse 3, that... Then the queen answered, "If I have found favor." So that "found" can also read obtained. Literally, it should read, "If I have found favor." So we've seen this idea of her finding favor. She's found favor in the king's eyes from the very beginning. There was a moment where she kind of wondered if she had lost favor because she hadn't seen him for 30 days. But she's asking him, "If I have found favor in your sight, still, Lord." So again, she is kind of kissing up to him in a way of just ensuring that he still sees her the way he had, you know, years ago when he first laid eyes upon her. So it's just an excessive flattery in her language. She's basically repeating herself using different words just here in this verse. "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, if it please the king." She's just saying it over again. She says few words, but her words say so much. She's asking for her life and her people's life to be spared. So this is the first time that she is now associating herself with the Jews in front of the king. Up until this point, we have no indication that the king knew that she was a Jew, right? So now she is finally associating herself. Now, it doesn't seem that the king is quite yet aware of who the people are that she's talking about, because then he's going to ask, who is it and who has done this? So it doesn't seem like he quite understands the trail she's going down. But this is the first time she is addressing herself before the king, associating it with the Jewish people. All right, so then that in verse 4, it says, "For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed." She is indicating to the king that she knows Haman bribed the king. Now, we don't know what was in the edict. We know that Esther read the whole edict, but we don't know what all was entailed there. I can't imagine why the 10,000 talents would have been added into the edict. I would think that it would just be that the Jews are to be annihilated. So she is here telling the king, "I know that you were bribed into it." Now, we know that Xerxes didn't accept the 10,000 talents. He said, "No, keep your money." But she knows that Haman tried to bribe him into it. So she's saying here, "I have been sold," insinuating, "I know that you were offered money for these people." Then, Let's see. So then where it says, I and my people to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. So she is heavily, she's making it clear that this is not just that they were sold as slaves, they were to be destroyed. And she says, repeats herself three times to emphasize destroyed, killed, and annihilated. She wants him to know that he did not just pass this edict to enslave the people, but also to destroy them.
That was also used in chapter 3.
Yes. 13. Yep. Yes. So she used the very words from the edict that would have been put out. So he knows that she's read the edict, or at least it's been read to her. She knows the exact words that were said in it. Yep. Also, we see, again, Esther is very careful in how she states her plea to the king. Because if she were to say, "You did it, you did it, king," it probably would have turned him off a little bit. But she's very careful to say that I and my people, she doesn't call him out immediately on what he did. Because it was his edict, it was his seal that signed the edict. So he was the reason that it went out. So instead of saying, "You sold us out," she's very careful and calculated. She said, "My people and I have been sold," so as not to charge him directly. She's very intelligent. Right. Yeah, she would have been. Yeah, she probably would have only been in her 20s. Or possibly not even 20. She could have been 18 or 19. This last part of verse 4, "If we have merely been sold, merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss of the king." For the loss of the king. Yep. There's some different.
Mine says wouldn't be worth burdening.
Yep. So.
Yeah, with annoyance.
This verse, all the commentators said, there's three words here, and I tried to go through and like figure out all of the different things, but I'm going to give you kind of a brief synopsis. Okay. All of the commentators said in this section of the verses, there's three words that could have, each of those words could have different meanings. And so it makes translating the verse, like Kyle said on Sunday, there's only so many Hebrew roots, and then we have all of our words in English. And so sometimes there's not a perfect word. So the commentators had to try to do their best to, with the context that we're given and with the Hebrew words that were given, to try to make sense of what it was actually saying. But there's three words here, tesar, soe, and nezek, that each of those words have a different meaning, hence why each one of your Bibles says something different. Okay, I can give them to you. Try your best. Right, yep. So for tesar or hasar, it's probably pronounced hasar, but it's spelled T-S-A-R. That would translate over to enemy, or let me, in mine it would say, So can you read for me the end of verse 4? Because in mine, it's a little...
Yeah, now if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with the annoyance to the king.
Okay, so where Macius...
trouble in my... it says enemy.
Yes, so that trouble or enemy, it can be either trouble or enemy. So the idea in Hebrew is it's an adversary, a foe, an oppressor, calamity, distress, trouble. So they had to try their best. So that's why Kyle says, be thankful for your translators, because it is a hard job for them to try their best to translate it in what the Hebrew would have said, because they both have to try to do it. They're trying to do it for the right word, but then also the right idea of what's going on, right? So, okay, and then after
the
read it, sorry.
Would not be commensurate with the annoyance to the king.
Yes. So that that compensate,
commensurate
is the, in Hebrew it would have been nezek, N-E-Z-E-Q. It can also mean financial loss, trouble, or annoyance. And then where it says, sorry, I'll let you guys finish writing.
And ours says annoyance to the king.
Okay.
Oh, NES says annoyance.
Okay. So then in the very end where it says annoyance with king or loss to the king, wouldn't be worth it. The Hebrew word is soweh, S-O-W-E-H. It's the equal meaning would be to agree with, to be equal to, similar, equivalent, suitable, comparable. Some think that the noun form means harm or damage, which then could possibly mean the monetary loss. That some of the commentators were saying that maybe she was implying that the king was going to have a financial loss in what she was requesting. And so they were saying that word can also be translated a monetary loss or a financial loss. So I know that's probably as clear as mud. I'm trying my best to make sense of what they were saying. All right. So essentially it should read that verse down there, for the calamity is not comparable with the trouble to the king.
Which is basically it is, the
right.
NES says.
Right. Yep. And probably the Holman says very similar as well. Right, Marian? The end of verse 4. Yeah. Right. Yeah, which is essentially the same thing. Yep. Yep. Clear as mud. Okay. All right. So this is Esther's impassioned plea. One commentator even wondered if since a lot of these words have a double meaning, he wondered if it was intended by the writer. That maybe these, because they all, if that double meaning was intended to say that, it's kind of an idea that Esther's ideas are kind of, there's a double idea there of this monetary loss, but also just the troubling of the king is potentially. So that's possible. The writer would have been, had to have been very intentional in his writing to know that there was a double meaning in some of these words put there.
How would monetary loss?
In the sense that I think she's thinking that you are going to have to, you would have to go about it differently than how it's already been put forth. So if you're going to go about a situation differently, maybe you're going to have to put out people in their job position or something in a different way. The commentator said that it's just that there's going to be a change in how you're doing things. And so then therefore you're going to have to pay people to change how you're doing it. And so potential monetary loss.
No, because if the king's going to do something about it and grant Esther her request,
okay,
it's going to be effort for him and trouble to figure out, because he can't change his edict.
Right.
So now he has to come up with some roundabout right. way to save the Jews, and that's going to be trouble and outlay on his.
Right.
Could result in a financial.
Right.
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 To be fair, he doesn't take any trouble to come up with the solution.
No, he doesn't. Like, right. he hasn't in the whole entire book of Esther.
Esther is always...
She's appealing to him because she know you have to. You have to appeal to the empire on their terms. You can't appeal to them on your terms. If she were to go to him and say, "You got to do what I want you to do," like it doesn't work that way. The empire, it's not like we have a constitutional right to our humanity in America. Theoretically, yes.
Sorry.
Way to just make it political, Misha.
Sorry, I couldn't help
just
it.
Just kidding. In the Persian Empire, there was no pursuit of happy, you know, there was none of that. There was no constitutional right to your life. The constitutional right was whatever honored the king. That was their constitution. Was whatever the king wanted, that's what happened.
Also, they wouldn't get all that plunder from killing them.
Right, right. They wouldn't have, yep. You're right. And I mean, yeah, because that's what... Either way, they're not going to be able to plunder the Jews, no matter how you... Yeah, right. Yep. Okay, so then verse... Just make sure I got that. Okay. Verse 5 says, "Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, 'Who is he and where is he and who has dared to do this?' So you're kind of like, you. Like, you did it. But she's very gracious, and she doesn't say that. But I'm sure she was tempted to say that. Like, you did it, Mr. Xerxes. Like,
the Holy Spirit wasn't around then, but she had great...
restraint.
Yes. She worked
on. I know. So Xerxes is putting distance between himself and the edict. You know, his words are kind of in this derogatory tone of like, who could have possibly done this? You know, how dare he?
It's interesting that he says he. Who instead of, you know, a group of people. Or
right.
He's already picked that it's one person. Sure. Doing
sure.
He can't remember that he did it?
Apparently not.
They were drinking.
But we've seen over and over again. I mean, he's really clueless to a lot of things. And so he just kind of. Yeah, right. I mean, he didn't even inquire about who the people were when he made the edict. He didn't inquire about who was the ones who were going to be annihilated. And so he's just kind of in his own world. Yep. Exactly. That's exactly. Yeah. Yep. I know, right? Who? I don't know. Yeah, I don't know who it was that made that. Oh, right. Yes. 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 True. Yes. You're right. Yep. Tradition. Right. 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 I know. Right.
Maybe the king never, because he gave him his ring and said, do what you want.
Yep.
He never even knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's very possible.
Yeah, but he had not even read it himself.
Right.
Because he gave his ring to Haman, and it said they came and they took down Haman's orders and sent them off to the
king. Right. It just, but it does say,
did he mention the Jews specifically?
He didn't. He said there's a people, because it says in verse 8, there's a certain people, chapter 3, verse 8, there's a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all their provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents. So he doesn't ever say specifically the Jews, he just targets a certain people and that they need to be destroyed. And obviously, and the king didn't ask. Who are you talking about? You know, it just says somebody in your empire. Yeah. And then, yeah, verse 10. So the king took the signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. A Agagite. Yeah. Okay. Let me just see. Where it says, who has dared to do this? Where is he and who has dared to do this? It literally could read, filled his heart to do, when it says dared to do. So where is he and whose heart has been filled to do this? So like I said, when one intercedes with the empire, one has to do so on the empire's terms. Esther could not simply just appeal to the king's sense of right and wrong and directly point out genocide is evil, because he obviously didn't think it was evil, because he didn't have any question about it in the first place when he gave him the signet ring. He signed it with his seal. The only constitutional given in the empire was the right of the king to maximize his own interest.
I find so many problems with this system.
Yes. Esther was well aware that for Xerxes, the empire's needs trumped issues of mere personal freedom. There was no constitutional right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in the Persian Empire. So if she found favor in the king's sight, then an attack on her was an attack on his royal person, because she is his wife, the queen. So she's trying to set it up as as such. We also have to understand that not all injustices can be set right in the course of earthly events. So Esther will attempt to focus the king's anger on the maker of the edict as opposed to him signing off on it. So she's manipulating him, basically.
She also probably knows him fairly well and knows that he's clueless.
Yep.
And probably knows that, yeah, you know, he probably realizes my husband really doesn't even know what was on him.
Mm.
Very possibly from other things
sure.
that she's seen in the past.
Sure.
At least 5 years, I think, at least.
Yeah.
Right, yep.
And so I'm sure she has seen where he's not really micromanaging
right.
the daily ins and outs of
right.
part of the kingdom. So
right.
she may have thought it's fairly highly likely he doesn't really
sure.
know exactly what he ordered.
Right. But if nothing else, his seal was on it. So
right,
she's
you know,
trying to say, right. She's even if he is clueless, she's still not calling him out
right.
in
responsibility.
In right. She's choosing to go about it a little bit in a roundabout way. Mm-hmm. Right. Which, I mean, in a way, in the day that we live in today, sometimes that is how, like, there is times where we have to be stand up and say this is the truth, but then it seems that there are times that it doesn't seem like you can get around it any other way than by playing by their rules and trying to work your way in to a position, you know, that I don't think it's a whole lot different than sometimes what we have today. Okay, verse 6. And Esther said, "A foe and an enemy, this wicked Haman." Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. Right. So Esther has, you know, just like Mordecai said, there is such, maybe God has made you for such, created you for such a time as this, and this is her moment. And so Esther doesn't just state that man Haman. She doesn't just point to him and say Haman. She uses three adjectives to describe his despicableness. She says that he's a foe, an enemy, and he's wicked.
Right. Esther invited me with right. nobody else.
Yep. She played you. yeah, he thought that she honored him highly, and he thought that's the reason she was inviting him to the banquet. But in fact, she was inviting him for the exact opposite. It could also read an adversary, enemy, or even, I don't know if the NASB or the Holman says either of those, adversary, enemy, or evil.
Adversary, enemy, and evil.
Mm-hmm.
Foe, enemy, wicked.
Uh-huh. Yep. So Esther targets his character, not just his anti-Jewishness or his anti-Semitism. Is that a word? Anti-Semitism? Yeah. She's casting him as her enemy because now she has lumped herself. She just told the king, me and my people. So she's lumping herself with these people that Haman is trying to come against. He has so now she is letting the king know, Haman, your buddy, has conspired against your queen, against her life.
So really, no one could have known Esther's relation to Mordecai.
Right.
Mm-mm. So when she's quiet
even Haman
about her Jewishness, she has to be quiet about all her relations.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But didn't he come to the gate every day to see her?
He did.
To I think ask about her,
well,
but
even to ask about her that.
But it seems like Haman and the king are kind of far removed, even from some of the officials who are running the court, because it seems so. We can't be dogmatic. Obviously, we don't know for sure, but it seems like the king, and even when I read a lot of the texts of historical, the king is always secluded to this very certain area of the palace. And he, until he like goes and roams about the city, he's just kind of there, you know, in his own, even when they were eating, I just read a couple days ago that even when they ate and even when they would have guests come and eat with them, he sat in a room and there was a partition and they sat on the other side of the room. So he was still separated from even guests who would come and eat with him. So it's very possible that some of the officials in the court, like obviously we knew that servant who went, gave the messages back and forth, he obviously knew that she was a Jew because of the conversation that went back and forth. But yeah, it's very likely that neither Haman or Xerxes knew the relationship between Esther and Mordecai. Maybe some of the other officials did, you know, the servants that served with her. They would have known, but it's possible that Haman didn't even know. Because you would think, if he had a smart brain, that if he's killing Esther's family, like, I don't know, you would just...
you'd think that there's a possibility it might not end well.
Right, right. That he could get in serious trouble with the king for that, you know, if he knew that. All right. So not just anyone had been condemned in this edict. It was the Jews, and Haman knew that. It was just the Jews. The king may not specifically know that until now, but Haman definitely knew it. So when she associates herself with these people in the edict that was put out, Haman knows immediately, oh, snap. I'm not only condemning Mordecai, but I am condemning the queen, the wife of the king.
Now, I wonder, because she says, I've been sold, my people to be destroyed, killed, annihilated. Does Haman pick up on it then? Or are there multiple people groups that are going to be wiped out? And so maybe, you know, I don't know.
Sure.
But it would seem like that
he would start to get the
common edict.
Right, right.
And so even when she's talking there, he might have that sinking feeling in his
stomach. Right. Because, I mean, you don't want to just wipe out your whole empire, because you need the people for your empire, you know? You need them to honor you. You need them to pay the taxes. You know, you need your people. So, yeah, you wouldn't think that they'd just be slashing people left and right. But I would think he was starting to get the idea if he didn't right there.
He's already trapped. He has nowhere
right.
to go.
Right, right. Okay. And it's also... The commentator noted that it was interesting that then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. It's kind of making this distinction that the Haman was standing by the king coming into it. So it's, you know, it's kind of Esther against the king and Haman. But now there's this distinction of Haman was now before the king and the queen. And now he is facing them and in opposition to the king who he just stood by. Okay, verse 7, or can someone read for us verses 7 through 10? We might finish early today.
Wow. The king arose in his anger from drinking wine, again, and went into the palace garden, but Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm had been determined against him by the king. Now when the king returned from the palace garden into the place where they were drinking wine, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, will he even assault the queen with me in the house? As the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs who were before the king, said, behold, indeed, the gallows standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on behalf of the king. And the king said, hang him on it. So they hanged Haman on the gallows, which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided.
Hmm. All right.
Backfire.
Right?
My commentary thought it was funny that this was the first time the king went and made his own decision by himself.
although, we will see.
But not even, because it was the eunuch that suggests it.
Oh, that's true.
And...
The garden to think by himself.
Yes, he did go think, but... Well, we'll get to it in a minute. We'll get to it when we get to that verse. I'll go back to that. Okay, so read for me again your verse 7. Just that very first when he rose.
Rose in his anger.
Okay, so it can also be translated arose in his wrath. So it's just the ESV translated as arose in his wrath because it's just the idea that this was not just some meek form of anger. He arose and he stormed out of there. He was livid. Because now he realizes that this edict was out against his own wife. So he is, and it's essentially his best friend, his right-hand man, who has put this edict out and has manipulated him into putting this edict out. Now, manipulated is a little bit of a stretch because he didn't even ask any questions about it. So, but you can imagine that he is incredibly angry with Haman. The king rose in his wrath. Okay, so he stormed out. And now Haman should be shaking in his boots. And it says he was terrified. Back in verse 6, it said he was terrified. Now, so he went out into the palace garden to go think. And now Haman throws himself down at Esther's feet. It was kind of common practice that when something tragic happened, or when you're begging for your life, they would have thrown themselves down at the person's feet begging for mercy. Okay, so what's interesting here, I read that royal etiquette would have been in the royal palace that you were not to approach a woman closer than 7 steps away. So him throwing himself down at the feet of Esther and, you know, maybe grabbing her feet or whatever, that would have been against the etiquette. So now when King Xerxes comes back in and sees, it's not literally that he was assaulting her or raping her. It's just he was putting himself in a compromising position by touching her in some way and begging for his life. What's a little ironic is he kind of fulfills his wife's prophecy of you will surely fall before, you know, back in 6 verse 13, she says, if Mordecai before him whom you have begun to fall is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. So she knew. She said, you're going to fall. And isn't it ironic that he does? He physically does fall before her feet. Yes. And, go ahead and read your verse says it falls before the couch.
Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was.
Mm-hmm. And that idea, what the commentators were saying, is just from history's sake, when people were begging for their life, oftentimes, she may have been sitting down on the couch, but he would have just fallen down before her, whether it was on the couch. And in tradition, they would have grasped their feet to beg for their life. So that was kind of where they were.
And wouldn't this have been a couch like what you lie down to eat?
It's possible.
Mine says
reclining. Right, a reclining couch. Right. Yep.
So we sit up to eat, but they would recline.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So he could even be at her feet at the
right.
other end of the couch.
Right.
You know, and you know, still be falling.
Yep. Because where does yours say reclining, Marion?
Just as the king returned from the palace, guards at the house of wine drinking, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was reclining.
Okay. Yep.
Oh, you add.
Yep. So yours doesn't add the reclining
was.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So. Well, yeah. Yeah.
They're at the banquet.
Right. Drinking wine. And if that was kind of, she's trying to maybe keep things on the down low instead of being so, you know,
dramatic.
Like, yeah. Right. Dramatic. I don't know.
Was the tradition for just women in the palace or women in general?
To
7 steps.
Yeah.
That I couldn't find that specific detail. It just said that the general palace etiquette was not to approach the women in the palace. So I'm not sure if it was also. But even today in Iran, you are not. I read that you are still not to. When you greet someone, opposite sexes are not to greet each other. It's supposed to be male to male, woman to woman. Even like you can kiss each other on the cheek, you can give each other a hug or a handshake. But even today, it's. You're forbidden to approach the opposite sex in normal life. So I'm not sure in that time if it would have been as well, but okay. Let me see where we are. Okay, so then now let's get back to when he storms out. When he arose in his wrath and he storms out, it is very unlikely that he's kind of put in a hard position because Haman has given him this idea for an edict to destroy the Jews, which includes his wife, but he signed off on it. So he can't really punish Haman because he signed off on it. So now he's in a dilemma. So I think that's a big reason why he storms off, because he's like, well, what do I do now? Because I can't kill Haman for the thing that I signed off on. So I'm sure he's mulling over, how am I going to get myself out of this predicament? So it probably wasn't just for him to cool off or have time to think. He would have easily wanted to just off Haman right away, but now he's being put in this predicament because he authorized the edict.
M.O. is just to kill whoever
right,
gets in his
way. Right, because he could have easily, but now he's stuck in this position of he was the one who approved it. than in verse 8 when Haman falls before Queen Esther and is putting himself in this compromising position, whether it was him grabbing her feet, whatever he was doing, he fell before her. And when the king saw that, it's very unlikely that the king actually believed he was attempting to rape her, because, I mean, really, Mordecai just saw the king walk out in fury. Haman, Haman just saw the king walk out. You really think his first thought is, I'm going to go rape his wife? No, that's not realistic. Right. That's right. Right. So what's likely happened is when King Xerxes came walking back in, he saw Haman in this in a compromising position and thought, oh, there's my out. I can say that he assaulted him, and that's a perfect reason to kill him. Mm-hmm. So Haman kind of remedied his problem for him. So he still didn't really have to do a lot of thinking for himself. Okay. Okay, and it's also... let's see. I think we read that part already. Yeah, it was a convenient charge to take care of this issue. It's ironic that the one who wanted to kill a Jew for not falling down or bowing down before him ultimately was executed on the charge of falling down inappropriately before a Jew. Haman wanted to kill Mordecai because he would not bow down. And now Haman is going to be executed for falling down before a Jew. Which again goes back to that kind of prophecy that his wife shared with him, that you will fall before a Jew. So God's providence is all throughout this story. All of these things, they cannot possibly just be by chance. They are absolutely a divine act of God working behind the scenes. We don't see him physically, you know, these big pillars of smoke in this story, but we see him moving all the pieces behind the scenes. So the final blow to Haman's life comes by a way of false accusation. The whole incident is based around the king's concern for his own honor. The end of verse 8 where it says, and they covered as, I'll read all of verse 8. And the king returned from the palace garden to the palace where they were drinking wine as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. And the king said, will he even assault the queen in my presence in my own house? As the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. So it's like he probably signaled to his gut, those axemen that are standing right there ready to take out. He probably signaled to them, hey, yep, you're ready to go. Go take him out. And then as soon as the words were out, they covered his face and they took him away.
And so covered his face, what significance is it? Or
what did
you find?
Yeah, so what they said is that it was an act of covering implies guilt or shame. Mm-hmm. And we even see that in Psalm. Can someone flip to Psalm 34, 4 through 5? Yes, Psalm 34, verses 4 through 5. Oops. So in the Lord, our faces are going to be revealed and they will never be ashamed. But here, it is covered out of shame and out of guilt. This would have been a common practice for execution in the Greek and Roman times. So it's likely that transferred over even into the Persian area, that they would have that covering implies that guilt or shame. No, they didn't give an indication, but likely like a sackcloth or, you know, maybe I'm sure they would have had.
They would have had to have that in their hand.
Sure. Right. I think they did because those axemen that stood at the king's side ready, because if somebody came to the king who wasn't invited, they were allowed to go and execute them by the king's command. So likely they would have had those things on hand for any time such as that. It just was just, yeah. Just pulled it out of their pocket. Yep. Yeah, because I think it seems that there was times like when he was out wandering, like when they were in war, there was times recorded where they would just off their head right there. But it's likely that that didn't necessarily, like, I don't know that he would want them to off their head right in the palace in his inner court. You know, maybe they would take him away a little bit, like they cover him and take him away and, you know, execute them. So a little more humane, I guess. I don't know, at least for the king. So Haman has no opportunity for defense, right? It's just immediate. He's not put on trial, just like he did with the Jews. He didn't give Mordecai an opportunity to go on trial. He didn't give the Jews as a whole an opportunity. He immediately acted on this edict, and now it's coming to bite him in the butt because now Xerxes immediately takes him away. Okay, so then verse 9 through 10, then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance on the king, said, moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high. And the king said, hang him on that. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the wrath of the king abated. So it is very likely that this Harbona is the same Harbona from in chapter 1. There was a whole list of eunuchs that were listed off. If we want to read back to chapter 1, verse 10 says, on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abitha, Zethar. So it's likely that's the same Harbona that we see are seen here.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Yep.
Mm.
Okay.
So
sure. Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. It probably would have been his first, you know, those are like the best of the best servants. Those are the people who are immediately around him doing those immediate. Right. Yep. Yep. It's his. Well, by now. I know.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Well, and it's... Sorry, go ahead. Finish.
No, I'm done.
Well, I was just going to say, but it was only yesterday that his wife suggests he build the gallows. Because he goes in the morning to ask the king. So it was constructed quickly.
Immediately.
The word must have spread.
Right.
Yeah,
I'm
right.
Yeah, because he would have had to have enlisted people.
Like, what's this?
Right.
You know, and at that point, Haman is proud and whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But
it's
just
supposed to be one of a fairly tall gallows, so that way it was noticeable.
Right.
Mordecai's shame.
Right.
A couple weeks ago when we were talking about that, it would have been 75 feet. Let me see where it is. 75 feet high. But a lot of the commentators I read said it's probably unlikely that it was actually a 75-foot gallows, that may have included the hill it was on top of. But either way, it was a point to
draw
shame and humiliation to the person who was put up there so that everyone could see them and he would be put to shame. But I know, I thought the same thing that you said, Joyce, that I'm kind of thinking this Harbona didn't really care for Haman because he seems pretty, like, excited to say, here, you know, the one that was offered for Mordecai, let's hang Haman on that. I don't know. Who knows if that, yeah. Okay. So again, we see the eunuch. Remember the eunuchs that they're going to usher Haman away. So he informs the king of the recent gallows that are constructed by Haman to use for Mordecai. You know, the one that was just honored. Yeah, that one. We've got a gallows that was supposed to be made for him by Haman.
Sorry.
No,
and
you're fine.
Haman never got the chance to ask the king.
Right,
if
he didn't.
Kill Mordecai.
Right.
So this might be news to the king.
Right.
The king had just honored him that morning.
Right. Yep.
Which would have
exactly
made him even more mad.
Right. For sure. Yep. Right. Yeah. Because Haman never got a chance to ask him. So, yep, this would have been the first time he was hearing that Mordecai was going to be killed, or wanted him to be killed that day. Yep. So the evil he planned for Mordecai was now his fate. In Proverbs 26, it says, whoever digs a pit will fall into it. So like we talked about earlier, that the hanging could also mean impaled, mm-hmm. because in that time it was more likely that they were impaled by a tree as opposed to maybe what we exactly envision. But we don't know for certain. It's just because of historical accounts, they typically impaled them with a tree or onto a...
What about the 50 cubits?
The height?
Yeah.
That's where a lot of people were saying, is it that they were impaled, like in the sense of how Jesus was, where he was impaled, or were they impaled on the top of the... It's a little bit unclear specifically. The only reason that they really think it was more that they were literally impaled on a tree is because of some of the history surrounding that time and how they executed people.
Impale them and then lift them up on a big mm-hmm. stake. So,
right,
you know,
right.
That everyone can see them.
But the bigger thing is that it's less likely that he was hung as in by a noose. It was more likely that he was impaled to it. Whether it was truly
nailed to it
or that he was impaled, that's what they're not exactly positive. Yeah. Yeah, it was just more unlikely that it was hang in a gallows as we would look at a gallows with a noose. Okay. So, like we said last week, in 24 hours, he went from being the second in command to now being dead. And we would have never believed, you know, in our humanness that could possibly happen, because... how can you go from such a high prestigious position to now being dead? That doesn't happen, you know, in our mind. It doesn't happen in this world. But God works far outside of our world, our ways.
In verse 10, it says, so they hanged him. Is there, what is the Greek word for hanged?
I don't know. I'd have to look it up. I did not look it up. Because
my verse under gallows, it says literally tree.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right.
So it's literally, so they hanged Haman on the tree.
Right. The distinction is more so, is the hanging, some people, when we look at it, we see hanging as they use the big tree to hang someone from a noose. But in that time, it was more likely that they would have nailed him like they did with Jesus on the cross or impaled him with a tree.
Okay.
No, it is.
Gallows out of a tree.
Right. It's built from a tree. That gallows is literal, could also be tree. Like that they're using a wooden structure in order to set up like a tall, you know, long wooden pole, which would be a tree, because in their time, you know, they're just going to cut down a tree and chop, you know, put it up. So then they would have put that up and then impaled him on it, whether that's by nailing him like Jesus was, or is that impaling on the top.
Well, and I think it all goes back to Deuteronomy. It's Deuteronomy 21, 22, and 23. It says, if a man has committed a crime punishable by death, he is put to death, and you hang him on a tree.
Mm-hmm.
His body shall not remain all night on the tree, but you shall bury him the same day, for a hanged man is cursed by God.
Right.
And the idea is not a tree, just a literal tree. But, I mean, because we say Jesus died on the tree, right? And
right.
This is Jesus taking our curse for us, and we see he is cursed because he was hung on a tree.
Right. So
it refers back to Deuteronomy, to the law that anyone hung on a tree is cursed.
So the physical structure they would have used
would have been wooden, not necessarily you know, a pine tree.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yep.
And it's kind of, the point is, whichever way for sure it was done, it was supposed to be.
Right. Execution. Right.
Right.
Right. Yep. Exactly. Yep. Hence the reason that it's such a high gallows. Does that make sense, or is that still confusing? Good? Okay. All right. So the villain has been eradicated. Haman's done. He is gone. But our story is still not over, right? Why? What else has to happen? Right. Yes, we've got to figure out how to reverse that edict. And we know the end of the story, but So we just, these were some of my final thoughts. We have seen an intricate interplay between human responsibility and divine sovereignty, because it did take Esther going before the king, right? It took her action of going and appealing on behalf of her and her people. But yet at the same time, it also was a divine act of God playing all of these things out and putting them into the position of where they needed to be. So that's for us. We can say with confidence that Scripture says it is both. It is both. We have a human responsibility being on this earth, but God has divine sovereignty and providence in orchestrating everything. And how those two things work in tension, my mom and I were just talking about this earlier this week, how those two things work together, I don't know. I don't know how God makes it happen, because it's like, it doesn't seem to make sense. Like, how can you work both of those things together? But yet Scripture is so clear. Psalm 127 says, unless the Lord builds the house, those who build labor in vain. The Lord is the one who builds the house. Now, does the Lord physically build our houses? No, we have to physically build our houses, but yet he is the one who has established it. He is the one who has orchestrated all of these things, and we've seen it all throughout Esther. I mean, Esther shouldn't have even been a queen. She was an orphan. She was a Jew. There was a million reasons to why she shouldn't have been a queen, and yet she was. And who made that happen? God made that happen. And so then we can say in our life, if he did it in Esther's life, he has done the same thing in our life. He has orchestrated in his providence everything that we have done. And now in terms of, I mean, we want to see our friends come to the Lord. We know that them coming to the Lord is only a work of the Lord. It can only be by the Holy Spirit, by the Lord, enabling them to do that, that they come to the Lord. But does that disregard our action in the matter? No. We still have to share. God still has called us to go out to the nations and tell of the good news, right? He has still called us to be those disciples. So we are acting out in faithfulness and in obedience, because that obedience and faithfulness glorifies him. And that is our ultimate purpose in being here. The result is up to him. It's not, as much as I want to see the result of my friends and family coming to know the Lord, it is up to him. And we have great hope in leaving that up to him, you know, that it's not my job to save Zane. It is God's job. I am supposed to be obedient in what he's called me to, in being faithful in showing Zane who the Lord is and why we serve him. But it is God's job to save him. Only God can do that. There are those, I think, that we know who are kind of more the sit back type, and we just sit back and pray and let God do it. You know, unless a solution were dropped in their lap, we just kind of sit back and can pray. And then there are others who might have more of the mentality of, if I don't do something about it, nothing's going to be done. So therefore I have to do it, and kind of take all the responsibility. And so both, either of those by themselves are not great. You have to have them as a balance, because that's where we see in the Word that we have to have that balance, that yes, we do have to trust the Lord and leave it in his hands, but there is a call to action in certain things. And isn't that appropriate for our life today in our crazy world? So I think it was God's providence that we study Esther right now. Right. You get to be a part of that. In taking action, you're getting to enjoy the fruits of serving in God in those capacities. You know, that's a blessing and a privilege that we get to do that, that we get to be used by him. And then on top of that, he works it all out unto his providence. And it's just amazing to me, for sure. So anything before we go, any questions or comments before we finish? We're done a little bit early, but I couldn't get through chapter 8 to have prepared for today. So we're almost done. We only got 3 more chapters.
Chapter 10 is 3 verses.
That's true. We probably will do 10 with, so probably only 2 more weeks.
That's a conclusion, not a chapter.
Yeah, yeah. We'll probably, yeah, I'm sure we will combine 9 and 10. All right. I know, it's fine. All right, well, I will close this in prayer, and then we can go. Lord, just We just thank you again. We just thank you so much for how it is that you are able to work out your providence and our human action at the very same time. I'm just continually amazed as we get through Esther that you are able to do that. And I pray that we would recognize that even, although in our human mind we cannot fully wrap our minds around that idea or around that theology, it's impossible for us to fully understand in our human mind. I pray that we would take your word for what it is and trust that it does work together in tension, that you have made a way for it to happen, and that our purpose in being here is for your glory. And so we do get to take action. There are times where we are going to be called to action, and I pray that we would have the boldness that Esther did in this situation, in the face of danger and in the face of risking her life and in the face of risking her royalty, that she did choose to be bold. And I pray that we would also have that. We are faced with it, and we will be faced with those moments. And I pray that we would be able to draw upon the hope that we have in you, that we don't have to fear this world. We get to look forward to heaven, so therefore there's nothing we have to fear here. And so we just thank you for that reminder from Esther, and that we would take it into our lives. In your name, amen.